This episode features discussions of plotting, threats of violence against children, kidnapping, and bureaucratic incompetence that some may find offensive. Listener discretion is advised, especially for children under 13.
July 4th, 1874. Philadelphia families filled the streets for an Independence Day celebration.
The noises rattled Christian Ross's nerves as he read and reread the ransom letter that had arrived on his doorstep regarding his missing 4-year-old son, Charlie. The letter was a hodgepodge of poor spelling, overt threats, and cocky bravado.
The kidnapper's instructions were simple. No police, no searching, wait for their demands. If Christian deviated from the plan for any reason, Charlie would die.
Christian was frantic. He wanted to turn to the police, but didn't know if he dared. Should he follow the kidnapper's instructions and pray they were honorable men?
For the first time in his life, he had no idea what to do, but the clock was ticking and he needed to act. Finally, Christian Ross made a decision that would haunt him to his dying day.
This is Hostage on the Parcast Network. I'm Carter Roy. Every Thursday, we tell the stories behind the most captivating hostage situations and the people inside them.
And I'm Irma Blanco. We'll also cover the psychological tactics used in hostage negotiations and what the human brain does when held captive.
At Parcast, we are grateful for you, our listeners. You allow us to do what we love. So let us know how we're doing. Reach out on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network.
And if you enjoyed today's episode, the best way to help us is to leave a 5-star review wherever you are listening. It really does help. We also now have merchandise. Head to parcast.com/merch for more information.
This is our second episode on hostage Charlie Ross, the first kidnapping for ransom in the United States.
On July 1st, 1874, two men abducted 4-year-old Charlie Ross from his yard in the Germantown neighborhood of Philadelphia. 3 days later, on July 4th, a ransom letter arrived in the mail. So began one of the most widely publicized and criticized police investigations in American history.
Last week, we met Charlie Ross, his father, Christian Ross, and our two alleged kidnappers, Bill Mosier and Joseph Douglas, who lured Charlie Ross and his brother Walter into their carriage after befriending the boys with candy.
This week, we'll look at the various parties competing for influence in the kidnapping case and the negotiations between Christian Ross, police, and the kidnappers.
Despite the kidnappers' threats, Christian decided to take the ransom letter to the police. It was a choice any parent would make, and even today, the FBI stresses that if your child has been kidnapped, your first response should be to contact an FBI field office or the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children at 1-800-THE-LOST.
In Christian's case, the police told him they needed time to strategize, so there was nothing left for Christian to do, save for the one thing he had been avoiding.
His wife, Sarah, still had no clue that her youngest child had been missing for 3 days. Christian carried his 5-year-old son, Walter, onto a train headed for Atlantic City, where Sarah was staying. He was not looking forward to the conversation.
A conversation that went as poorly as Christian suspected. Sarah seemed mad enough to strike him and scared enough to faint. Christian tried to assure her that they would soon have their son home again, that everything would be okay.
But as they arrived back in Philadelphia, they discovered that the city had been wallpapered with their heartbreak. In their absence, the police had printed off missing person flyers with Charlie's name and description and plastered them in every corner of the city. It was a sobering sight. One that immediately told the kidnappers that Christian had done the one thing they had asked him not to do. He had talked to the police.
To make matters worse, Christian's brothers-in-law had printed an ad in the public ledger offering a $300 reward for Charlie's return. In just under 24 hours, they had completely bungled the investigation. Christian was beside himself with worry that the kidnappers might hurt Charlie.
Then, the next morning, July 6, 1874, Christian received a call from his brother. He had found another ransom letter. It had been left against the front door of their clothing store. He tore it open and read it to Christian, saying, quote, "No harm has come to Charlie, but $20,000 is demanded for his ransom."
Christian recoiled. $20,000? They might as well have asked for the moon. In 1874, American President Ulysses S. Grant only earned $50,000 per year. With his failing business, Christian Ross could barely pay his household staff, let alone kidnappers who had mistaken him for a much richer man.
He read the letter, quote, "If you love money more than your child, you be its murderer, not us. For the money we will have, if we don't get it from you, we will make examples of your child that others may be wiser. Your money or his life."
Christian raced to police headquarters at Independence Hall. They'd had enough time to strategize. It was time to act.
But Christian arrived at Independence Hall to learn that Philadelphia Mayor William Stokely had turned the original ransom letter and the authority over the kidnapping case to a group known as the Philadelphia Council. Christian winced. This was bad news.
According to Charlie Ross researcher Carrie Hagen, the Philadelphia Council was comprised of wealthy politicians and business owners who controlled the city through a system of bribes, backdoor deals, and negotiations amongst themselves.
Council members included the editors of newspapers, export-import merchants, and the men who had convinced the American government to hold the country's upcoming centennial celebration in Philadelphia. In 1874, even the mayor was elected or rejected based on the influence of the council.
When the council saw the second ransom letter, it didn't take them long to reach a conclusion about the kidnapping. If the Ross and Lewis families paid the ransom, it would only be a matter of time before the kidnappers struck again. And they had a vested interest in deterring kidnappings for ransom, the upcoming centennial celebration.
Parents would never come to the centennial celebration if they thought their children were in danger of being kidnapped. How many other children might be stolen and ransomed if Christian Ross gave in to their demands?
The council told Christian he could not pay the ransom. They reasoned the kidnappers needed to keep Charlie alive to get paid so they wouldn't kill him. Once they realized there was no money coming, they would drop Charlie off somewhere.
The council also decided that they would negotiate with the kidnappers. Speaking as Christian, they would post a response to the letter in the newspaper in the hopes the kidnappers would see it. From there, they could find a more discreet line of communication.
But that decision proved to be a horrendous one. The public quickly figured out that the Ross family was using the newspapers to communicate with Charlie's kidnappers and began following the story like a tabloid.
And because everyone has an opinion, the police and city council soon found themselves in the line of fire for public criticism. People wanted to know why more wasn't being done to apprehend these kidnappers and save Charlie.
Meanwhile, the Ross family became local celebrities, which sent reporters digging into their backgrounds. Eventually, an exposé was published in a Philadelphia newspaper that exposed Christian Ross's money troubles.
Not only did the kidnappers now know he couldn't afford the ransom, his house staff learned that they weren't likely to be employed for much longer.
The newspapers also started printing every detail about the case they could unearth, which only served to keep the public and the kidnappers abreast of every move the police made in their efforts to recover Charlie.
At that point, police may as well have mailed the kidnappers their plan of action.
As a final act of embarrassment, a New York businessman offered to pay the entire $20,000 ransom for Charlie. He had assumed the only reason Christian hadn't paid already was because he couldn't afford to.
The truth was worse. Christian's brothers-in-law, the Lewis brothers, had already pooled the money. They had even gone behind the Philadelphia Council's back by placing an ad in the public ledger on July 13th, telling the kidnappers they were ready to deliver the ransom.
But the council demanded that the Ross and Lewis families let them mark the bills before delivery so they would be easier to track down. Christian worried that delivering marked bills would cost Charlie his life.
The kidnappers had been clear. Deliver the money, be discreet. So far, he'd failed on both counts.
Meanwhile, the police station was flooded with calls from across the country. Thousands of people were convinced they'd seen Charlie. Not that every call was useless. In July 1874 alone, six other missing children were serendipitously located as police followed up on these false leads about Charlie.
By the end of July, the entire country had heard about Charlie Ross and demanded action from Philadelphia police. I'm blissfully unaware, of course, that their involvement in the case was making it all the harder to return Charlie home.
Private detectives also got involved. At the turn of the century, it wasn't uncommon for self-proclaimed PIs to involve themselves in cases to collect reward money. In this case, $300 from the Ross and Lewis family for information leading to Charlie's return.
On July 17th, a private detective dragged a man into Philadelphia police headquarters and accused him of taking Charlie Ross. For the last 2 weeks, the detective had prowled Philadelphia's underbelly, listening for gossip of the kidnapping. He had eventually arrested a con artist named Christian Wooster.
The PI then told a journalist he had caught Charlie Ross's kidnapper, which sent reporters running to the police station. They wanted to know whether the con artist would only serve the maximum sentence of 7 years for kidnapping.
The solicitor put the journalists' minds at ease. The misdemeanor of kidnapping carried a sentence of 7 years, but additional charges, such as conspiracy to extort money, could be brought up against Wooster too. Once the charges were all levied against him, Wooster would likely rot in prison for the rest of his life.
But as was becoming routine with this case, the Wooster debacle only further hurt the case. Charlie's brother Walter didn't recognize Wooster as one of the kidnappers, and the police quickly learned Wooster hadn't even been in Philadelphia on July 1st, the day of the kidnapping.
When Wooster was released, he gave interviews insinuating that the private detective had knowingly lied to collect reward money. This once again opened the investigation up to criticism from the public and the council. But the real damage had already been done.
Newspapers had already reported that the police intended to send the real kidnappers away for life, something that neither Douglas nor Mosier had been counting on. Mosier had been sure that kidnapping a child would be a low-stakes, high-reward con. The newspapers said otherwise.
After the Wooster mess hit the papers, Christian realized that the kidnappers were stalling. In their next ransom letter, they told Christian that they had fled Philadelphia.
Christian tried to assure them that he had the money and was ready to exchange without police involvement, but the kidnappers accused Christian of lying.
Today, crisis negotiators would recognize the kidnapper stalling for what it really was, emotional vulnerability. The FBI's former chief crisis negotiator, Gary Nestner, says that the beginning of any negotiation is a delicate balance between emotion and rational thinking. As emotion flares, rational thinking declines.
Most hostage takers are operating on moment-to-moment mechanics, and until they feel understood, neither side is going to get anywhere. Anything that threatens their sense of control threatens the well-being of their victims as well.
Christian didn't have an expert like Nestner to help him through the ordeal, but he could sense the kidnappers were getting desperate, and desperate men are capable of terrible things. If he was going to see his son again, he needed to pay the ransom now.
Through further back and forth with the kidnappers, Christian convinced them that he was prepared to follow their instructions for a ransom drop-off in Albany, New York.
Christian detailed the kidnappers' instructions in his biography. On the evening of July 30th, Christian would ride to the West Philadelphia Depot and take a midnight train to Jersey City and then to Grand Central Station. There, he was to wait on the platform of the rear Hudson River car headed for Albany.
If a man had not made contact with him by the time he reached Albany, he was to visit the post office and ask for a letter addressed to C.K. Walter. The letter would tell him which train to ride back to New York.
Once aboard the train, Christian would wait in the rear car for a signal. When he saw a man with a torch or bell in one hand and a flag in the other waiting by the tracks, he was to drop the bag containing $20,000 and leave it behind.
The letter promised that after the money had been collected, Charlie would be abandoned and a letter would be sent to Christian detailing where to find him.
As complicated as it sounded, Christian was ready. He refused to listen to the Philadelphia Council when they urged him not to go.
But what should have been a simple ransom exchange would soon derail completely.
Next, a ransom exchange goes awry. Now back to the story.
By late July 1874, Christian Ross had finally convinced the kidnappers to agree to a ransom exchange. On July 30th, he would ride to Albany with $20,000 in cash and leave it for the kidnappers. They would send him a letter with directions to find Charlie.
But on July 29th, a postal worker spotted something alarming while riding the Reading Railroad. A Romani troop camped in the woods outside Hamburg, Pennsylvania, with a little boy matching Charlie's description.
Local police stormed the camp and arrested the entire troop. They wasted no time in telegraphing Philadelphia. They had found Charlie Ross. All they needed was someone to come to Hamburg to identify him.
Christian was dumbfounded. He refused to believe that this nightmare could really be over. He wanted to race to Hamburg to see the boy for himself, but he needed to be pragmatic. He sent the Philadelphia police chief and his brother-in-law, Joseph Lewis, to Hamburg in his stead. Meanwhile, he prepared to take a trip to Albany as planned.
At that exact moment, however, the Associated Press was already printing that Charlie had been found. The news set the city of Philadelphia abuzz as people began to gather in the streets and in pubs, waiting for confirmation that Charlie was coming home. But a telegraph from Hamburg arrived for Christian around 3 p.m. that day. It simply read, "Not Charlie."
Christian had already braced himself for the bad news, but it stung nevertheless. Every time a lead ran into a dead end, it felt like losing his son all over again. But the only way to move was forward. He gathered $20,000 in unmarked bills into a valise and prepared to make the ransom drop.
According to Hagen, the Philadelphia Council called an emergency meeting that day. Christian was leaving on the midnight train to Albany. If he paid the kidnappers and Charlie wasn't returned, they feared they could kiss a successful centennial celebration goodbye.
They summoned Christian to Independence Hall and told him that if he threw $20,000 onto the train tracks, he would never see Charlie again.
Whether this is true might be up for debate. Today, kidnapping for ransom is so endemic in certain regions of the world, such as Iraq and Colombia, that it has become a system that only works because victims are often returned alive and criminals are often paid. If either side of the scale was more prevalent, the balance wouldn't allow for as much success as hostage negotiators see in those regions.
On the flip side, when the ransom profit margins are very high, negotiators often stall to lower the amount so that it won't inspire more kidnappings. But given the circumstances, Christian Ross had done the best he could.
Eventually, Christian and the Philadelphia Council reached a compromise. Christian would carry a note to Albany instead of the money, demanding proof that Charlie was still alive, and request a simultaneous exchange of Charlie for the money. The note also requested that they stop communicating through public newspapers. At midnight on July 29th, Christian followed the kidnappers' path to Albany. His nephew, Frank Lewis, and an undercover police officer tailed him.
Hours ticked by. Eventually, the sky began to glow with morning color, and the train arrived in Albany.
Christian rushed to the post office, only to learn no letter addressed to C.K. Walter had arrived. He spent the rest of the day walking around Albany, returning to the post office to ask for the letter, but no such letter ever came.
The kidnappers had missed their own ransom exchange.
Devastated, Christian boarded the train back to Germantown. He couldn't understand what had gone wrong. He had followed every instruction to the last detail.
A new ransom letter arrived on July 31st, accusing Christian of breaking faith. The kidnappers chastised him for going to Hamburg, Pennsylvania, instead of following their instructions.
Christian was livid. The kidnappers had read the false newspaper articles claiming he had gone to Hamburg to identify his son. How could they believe that?
He published an ad the next day to clear the air. He had followed their every instruction, he wrote. It was they who had failed to show.
On August 3rd, the kidnappers wrote, again via the newspaper, to apologize for their mistake and suggested sending an agent to pick up the money directly from Christian's store. But by then, the entire ordeal had fanned the flames of suspicion and mistrust on both sides. The Philadelphia Council responded by demanding a simultaneous exchange. Charlie for the money. Nothing else would do now.
These types of ultimatums are what seasoned FBI kidnapping negotiators try to avoid because they're born of emotion and not strategy. Anything that antagonizes the person with the most leverage puts the victim at risk. And trust, on both sides, is often one of the determining factors in whether a kidnapping victim is recovered alive or not.
Throughout August, both sides quibbled over the details. The kidnappers refused to consider a simultaneous exchange. The Philadelphia Council refused to consider anything else. The Lewis brothers tried to convince Christian to stop listening to the council and just pay the kidnappers their ransom.
Newspapers across the country continued to print new theories about Charlie's disappearance. After the botched ransom exchange on July 30th, one of their favorite theories was that Christian Ross himself had orchestrated the entire kidnapping to cover up the murder of his own son.
Throughout August, ransom letters and responses were bandied back and forth between the council, Christian Ross, and the kidnappers almost every single day.
The investigation, however, was beginning to change. A new theory had emerged, proposed by George W. Walling, who had served with the NYPD for 27 years. As a captain and later an inspector, Walling had encouraged his police officers to carry clubs made of locust wood, one of the hardest timbers in North America. Now, as a superintendent, Walling wanted to make his mark on New York City and the world. It wasn't long before a sensational case had landed on his desk.
According to Walling's biography, throughout July, one of his officers in New York's 13th Ward had been following a lead on Charlie Ross. He had been meeting regularly with a horse thief named Gil Mosier, who claimed his brother, Bill, had kidnapped the Ross boy. Gil was willing to give his brother up in exchange for the $20,000 reward.
Walling asked Gil to produce a copy of Bill's handwriting for them to test against the ransom letters. He then reached out to Philadelphia and asked that the original copies of the letters be sent to New York.
On August 2nd, while Christian was still reeling from the failed ransom drop-off, his brother, Joseph Ross, brought Walling the letters. Held up side by side, Bill's handwriting and the ransom letters looked nearly identical. Joseph Ross was thrilled. The letters were even folded the same peculiar way. Joseph Ross couldn't wait to tell Christian, but Walling gently took him aside.
Walling suggested they not tell Christian until the information had been checked. There was no point getting Christian's hopes up.
It may have seemed like a kindness, but according to Hagen, Walling's true intentions were far less professional. The man who captured Charlie Ross's kidnappers and returned the boy safely would be a hero.
Walling wanted celebrity, and Gil Mosier wanted money. Together, they might be able to help each other. Where Charlie's survival fit into their plans was unclear.
At the end of the August 2nd meeting, Walling told Gil to flush his brother out of hiding and find out definitively if he was keeping Charlie somewhere.
Gil Mosier began searching for news of his brother in Slaughterhouse Point, the Five Points, and Brooklyn. The closest Gil could get was Mosier's brother-in-law, a disgraced former NYPD police officer named William Westervelt. Gil asked Westervelt to let him know if he ran into his brother. Instead, Westervelt met with Bill Mosier and warned him of Gil's suspicious behavior.
When Gil couldn't produce his brother for Superintendent Walling, he told him about Westervelt instead and insinuated he might be one of the kidnappers.
On August 10th, Walling finally reached out to Christian Ross and asked him to bring his 5-year-old son Walter to New York City to identify one of the kidnappers. Walling took Walter to a particular street corner and pointed Westervelt out. He asked Walter, quote, "Is that one of the men who took your brother?"
Walter shook his head. He had no idea who Westervelt was. Walling, however, was still convinced he had his man. He told his officers to find out all they could about Westervelt and Bill Mosier.
Back in Philadelphia, the council was feeling the sting of the public's blind need for justice. Already, Centennial Celebration benefactors were pulling their funding. Exhibit reservations made 2 years in advance were being canceled. If they had any chance of saving the city's reputation, they needed a new plan.
The police chief surmised that if letters were arriving at Christian's house and business on the same day posts of the kidnappers appeared in the newspapers, the kidnappers must be operating out of Philadelphia. He authorized a citywide search of every building and room.
Bill Mosier had read about the search, too. On August 14th, he called a meeting with William Westervelt and asked him to go to Philadelphia and convince his wife Martha to flee the city. Martha took 3 little boys and her infant daughter and relocated to New York City on August 17th, just hours before the citywide search began.
Martha and the 4 kids moved in with Westervelt's wife, Mary, and their 2 children. Mary resented that Martha often left one of her children for Mary to watch. He was a 4-year-old blonde boy with big eyes who hid from strangers. Martha called him Lovey.
In the wake of the citywide search, the kidnappers told Christian to begin communicating with them using the New York Herald. The ransom letters also began taking longer and longer to arrive at Christian's door. Christian rightfully suspected they had fled Philadelphia.
On August 17th, Superintendent Walling sent several police officers out to look for Westervelt. It's unclear why, but Westervelt walked himself into a police station later that same day. There, he was strip-searched and left to wait for 2 hours without cause. Then, he was escorted to Walling's private residence for interrogation.
Walling asked if Bill Mosier had taken Charlie Ross. Westervelt said no. But then Walling dangled a $20,000 reward in front of him, and Westervelt's story began to change. He told Walling he wasn't sure if Bill Mosier had the child. Walling asked Westervelt to turn informant for him, again offering the $20,000 reward. He sweetened the pot by promising to reinstate Westervelt as a police officer if he helped return Charlie to his family.
Westervelt agreed. Unbeknownst to Walling, however, Westervelt almost immediately began playing both sides.
By September 1874, the ransom letters were beginning to arrive less frequently. Every response printed by the council made Christian seem even more culpable in his son's disappearance. The 50-year-old's mental health deteriorated to the point that he became bedridden. Sarah Ross, her brother Joseph Lewis, and his son Frank took over the investigation.
They began ignoring the council's advice and writing ads to the kidnappers themselves. They just wanted Charlie back. Money was no object. But slowly, the Ross family began to realize that despite their best efforts, it was too little, too late.
Next, the stalemate finally breaks.
Now, back to the story.
The United States was still reeling from Charlie Ross fever in September of 1874, especially now that 2 separate police forces were working to rescue Charlie for their own selfish reasons.
On September 11th, William Westervelt gave Superintendent Walling his first solid clue in months. He told Walling that the buggy and horse used to take Charlie was rented from a barn on Marriott Lane in Philadelphia.
Philadelphia police rushed to investigate, and Westervelt's lead proved true. In a spooky and tragic twist, however, police discovered that the buggy and horse had been sold on July 1st, the very day of Charlie's kidnapping. Shortly after, the barn had been destroyed.
The original owner remembered the man with the eroded nose renting the buggy and horse. The horse and buggy had never been returned, and he had never made the connection to Charlie's kidnapping.
The tip from Westervelt confirmed to Superintendent Walling that he had the right suspect. Bill Mosier had taken Charlie. Now all he needed was to know where the boy was so they could swoop in, save him, and arrest Mosier.
However, Walling lied to Philadelphia PD here. He didn't tell them where the tip on the horse and buggy had come from. He didn't give up Bill Mosier's name. Instead, he warned Captain Hines not to let the Lewis brothers pay the ransom. If they did, it would neuter his attempts to arrest the kidnappers himself.
Walling was confident that he would soon be a national hero.
Throughout October and November 1874, Walling continued to pursue Bill Mosier in secret.
Walling's men tailed Westervelt and Joseph Douglas, hoping that one of them would lead police to Mosier. Curiously, they never realized that Mosier, his wife, and their children were staying in Westervelt's apartment at the time.
By November 16th, however, the Lewis brothers had had enough. Their sister missed her little boy. The police were clearly incompetent. The entire city seemed to be working against them. It was time to act. They placed an ad in the New York Herald, agreeing to pay the ransom once and for all.
They would wait in the Fifth Avenue Hotel in New York City all day on November 18th with $20,000 in unmarked $1 and $10 bills.
Unbeknownst to the Lewis brothers, Superintendent Walling told Westervelt to convince Bill Mosier and Joseph Douglas to take the money. Walling's men would arrest them, and Westervelt would be $20,000 richer by the next morning.
Westervelt agreed to Walling's plan, but warned him that if anything happened to the kidnappers, Charlie would be dead before the day was through.
Minutes ticked by like hours. Henry and Frank Lewis sat in their hotel room in near total silence for 48 hours, listening to every knock on someone else's door, every creaking board outside their own.
And yet, no one arrived to claim the money. Henry Lewis placed an ad in the Evening Herald on November 19th, accusing the kidnappers of breaking faith yet again.
Walling arrested Westervelt for the failure, but Walling had spent too much time and money cultivating the relationship to hold Westervelt for long.
Throughout the rest of November 1874, the kidnappers sent more ransom letters and the Lewis brothers tried to pay them without success.
Why weren't the kidnappers accepting the ransom? The Lewis brothers were willing to meet them at every turn. It made no sense.
Psychologists from the University of Benin studying kidnappers in Nigeria have found that kidnapping for ransom is seen as a semi-invisible, high-reward, low-risk type of crime. Worldwide, nearly $1.5 billion was paid in ransom to kidnappers in 2010. And the crime of kidnapping isn't prosecuted with the same severity as a bank heist or act of terrorism would be.
In the Charlie Ross case, however, what could have been a simple negotiation became a national sporting event that painted targets on the kidnappers' backs. It was too dangerous to take the money, and both sides found themselves in a terrible public stalemate.
As police investigated more Charlie sightings, they also found more and more missing children, and the nation responded with furious indignation. Why were there so many missing kids? What was the government going to do about it?
Historical anthropologists point to this moment in American history as one that changed the way we look at children forever. Before Charlie Ross's kidnapping, children had been an invisible, valueless population to everyone but their parents. After he disappeared, all children had suddenly become priceless.
Americans began demanding longer sentences for kidnappers. Desperate for votes, politicians agreed to change the law. As the kidnappers read more and more of these reactions in the paper, they could feel the nooses slipping tighter around their necks. Even if they returned Charlie Ross, the police might kill them. Hell, the public might take matters into their own hands.
Unbeknownst to Superintendent Walling, Bill Mosier's protege, Joseph Douglas, had had enough. On December 13th, he reached out to Westervelt and asked him to act as an intermediary between him and the police. Westervelt cryptically told Walling that Douglas wanted to discuss something.
Unfortunately, he would never get the chance.
At 2 a.m. on December 14th, 1874, John Holmes Van Brunt awoke to the sounds of an alarm. His brother had installed an alarm system between his house and the summer cottage next door, so that if an intruder entered one, the other home would be alerted. The additional security was necessary, considering his brother was New York Supreme Court Judge Charles Van Brunt.
Holmes' son Albert grabbed a pistol before running over to check in on his uncle's property. He and a gardener ran next door in time to see two men sneak through the judge's window. Albert ran back to tell his father, and together with a hired man, all four men rushed into the judge's summer home.
The four men saw two shadows make a hasty retreat into the cellar, pulling a trap door down over them.
Albert and the gardener cocked their pistols and approached the trap door. When the smoke cleared, the two men leaned down to look into the cellar. Then one of the men yelled out, "There they come!"
The two shadows dashed for the main basement staircase. One of the shadows yelled, "I give up!" But it was too late. He fell on the stairs, blood pooling around him in a growing halo. The men saw the second shadow.
As the shadow moved up the stairs into the light, one of the men of the house knocked the gun out of his hands.
The fight was already over. A dozen bullets had struck his arms, his chest, his head. Still, the intruder lived.
He stumbled out of the house and made it across the yard before collapsing. Neighbors began to gather. As they approached, a pool of blood began to spread at their feet. They turned the man over.
His stomach had torn open, exposing his intestines. The gunshot to his forehead dribbled blood. Two dozen people gathered around him, yelling angry slurs.
The man begged for a glass of whiskey. When a servant girl lifted a glass to his mouth, he couldn't drink it. She brought him water instead. Finally, the man told them his name.
Joseph Douglas.
Douglas began to speak. "Oh, madam, I've been a very wicked fellow. It's no use lying now. I helped to steal Charlie Ross."
The crowd grew silent. Men leaned in to take his confession, to ask where Charlie was hidden. All Douglas would say was that Bill Mosier knew where Charlie was. They told him Mosier was dead. Douglas wailed with anguish and spoke again, quote, "Inspector Walling knows, and the boy will get home all right."
Douglas bled out for nearly 2 hours before he stopped breathing at 5 a.m.
News of Douglas's deathbed confession spread fast. Before noon, on December 14th, news had already reached Philadelphia. By 2:30 p.m., Bill's widow, Martha, arrived at the morgue to identify his body. Gil Mosier, his wife Liz, and the wife of their brother Al Mosier arrived shortly afterward.
But where was little Charlie Ross? His fate, sadly, is far less conclusive. On December 15th, the wife of Al Mosier gave an interview with the press in an attempt to separate Martha's character from that of her husband Bill Mosier.
In the interview, when asked how many children Bill and Martha Mosier had, she said four. three boys and an infant girl. She then stated that one of the little boys, the one they called Lovey, had died. She didn't say how recently or from what.
Just 2 days later, on December 17, 1874, the Lewis brothers placed another ad in the newspaper offering immunity to anyone who returned Charlie. They wouldn't charge them. They wouldn't even let the police know they had come and gone. They just wanted Charlie back.
No one ever responded. After Bill Mosier and Joseph Douglas's deaths, no new ransom letters arrived until Christmas, and even then, the Christmas letter was soon proved to be a copycat.
Superintendent Walling fielded questions about why Douglas had said he knew where Charlie was being kept. However, Walling was quick to spin the entire incident by celebrating the fact that the two kidnappers were dead.
Although Walling's reputation was tarnished for the rest of his life, he wasn't held accountable for his part in prolonging the investigation. He gave interviews explaining that he had simply used standard investigative techniques and taken them too far in an attempt to save Charlie. As we explored last week, police departments at that time were barely more than adult clubs with the authority to arrest people. The expectations for Walling simply weren't that high.
As for Martha Mosier, it's unclear why no one investigated the claim that one of her children had coincidentally died the day her husband had been killed. A modern criminologist believes there is a historical gap between how women are perceived where crime is concerned, and much of it has to do with their social gender expectations. Especially when children are involved, there is a social disbelief that women would be violent on purpose. This was especially true in the 1800s, when a woman's entire identity was tied to motherhood.
In January of 1875, as the Lewis brothers continued pleading for the life of their nephew, the wagon and horse used to kidnap Charlie was finally discovered in Newark, New Jersey. Sure enough, when Walter went to identify the horse, it turned its head and smiled at him.
By February, state senators of New York and Pennsylvania agreed to change kidnapping from a misdemeanor offense into a felony. The bill contained a special addendum stating that the kidnappers of Charlie Ross would have 4 weeks to turn the boy into police and surrender to receive lighter sentences.
By then, however, it was simply a last-ditch, desperate plea. The Ross and Lewis families hadn't received a ransom letter in months.
On February 25, 1875, senators voted the change into law. Kidnappers would receive sentences of 25 years and their associates would serve for 15. Other states would soon follow suit.
In April, William Westervelt was arrested in Philadelphia and charged for his role in the kidnapping of Charlie Ross. He would eventually be found guilty and sentenced to 7 years of hard labor and solitary confinement at Eastern State Penitentiary.
When Christian Ross recovered from his illness, he began to search again in earnest for his little boy.
But Charlie Ross would never be found. Christian and Sarah Ross searched for him for the rest of their lives.
As tragic an ending as this is, the ordeal deterred other criminals from trying to ransom children for nearly 25 years. Today, one of the nation's largest missing persons databases, the Charlie Project, is named after Charlie Ross.
Charlie's kidnapping forever changed the way children were protected, both legally and by the community. Although, perhaps his kidnapping is most remembered by the age-old adage it inspired: don't take candy from strangers.
Thank you for tuning in to Hostage. We will be back Thursday with a new episode.
You can find more episodes of Hostage, as well as all of Parcast's other podcasts, on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Play, or your favorite podcast directory.
Several of you have asked how to help us. If you enjoy the show, the best way to help is to leave a 5-star review.
And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. We'll see you next time.
Hostage was created by Max Cutler, is a production of Cutler Media, and is part of the Parcast Network. It is produced by Max and Ron Cutler, sound designed by Dick Schroeder, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro and Paul Mahler. Additional production assistance by Maggie Admire and Carly Madden. Hostage is written by Jordan Trapier and stars Irma Blanco and Carter Roy.